history program interview, 11 October 1980, a general speech, ranch hand reunion, Texas A&M.
Before various congressional committees, that it doesn't bother me at all because they don't even listen to what you're saying. I'm delighted to be here. It's a very rich experience for me, and I mean that sincerely. I've had four such experiences in the last several weeks. I had an opportunity to speak to some students at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia, and I was caught up. Did you? Great. Well, I was caught up in being around Constitution Hall and getting kind of re-Americanized. And I thought that was a rich experience. I then went to Boston and had an opportunity to review historically the attack on Boston, Washington, and his assault on the British. The Battle of Breed's Hill, and I said, gee, that's a bit of American history, and I'm a little more Americanized again since I experienced that. 2 days ago, I was with the Physiologic Support Division out at Beale in California and talked to some of the SR-71 and U-2 people and saw them and talked to them after their missions and said, hey, you know, that's really something special. And how fitting it is that I can cap it all off by having the opportunity to be with this bunch of patriots tonight and try to bring into a little sharper focus, perhaps, the things that you have a concern for and that I have a concern for and that our country has a concern for. I have some prepared remarks, and I like to refer to those now because there are some aspects of what I will speak about that I would rather stay relatively close to center, and then perhaps as the discussion opens up, as you ask questions, we may be able to expand a little bit. I'd like you to know right up front at the very outset that we're very appreciative of the support and the encouragement we have received from you individually and as an organization. And I say on behalf of the Chief of Staff, General Allen, and the members of the Air Staff that we're truly very grateful. Last year, George Lathrop, who I think should certainly be appointed as your family doctor forevermore, he gave you a briefing of the plans of the study at that time. But we've had a number of changes made to the protocol, and I'd like to let you know what those amendments amount to. In general, this is the plan. In a few weeks, you'll be getting a letter officially informing you of the White House decision to have the Air Force proceed with the study. This will then be followed very shortly by a very personal letter from me with the details of the study, how it will be handled, what is needed of you, and the benefits to you. And I hope you do want to participate because your support is critical to the scientific success of this study. There are only 1,198 ranch handlers. Statistically, our scientists would desire a much larger group when conducting any epidemiologic investigation. But that's the total number. We can't make it any more. You're a most unusual group performing a very, very special task. And you played a key role in fulfilling the Air Force mission in Southeast Asia. You were all volunteers, and we need you to volunteer again. But it's a different type of mission, one which may be of significant benefit to you and certainly of significant benefit to many, many others. Our basic problem is that we don't precisely, and I underscore the word precisely, know the effects of herbicide Orange upon human beings. I don't think one can say it any more simplistically than that. And the purpose of the study is to determine whether there is a relationship between health problems and exposure to herbicide Orange. To do the study properly, we need to do an in-depth personal interview and perform a comprehensive physical examination. That health questionnaire is now being refined, and it's being refined by people who are experts in the questionnaire business. During the review process, several recommendations were made for inclusion in the questionnaire, and these inclusions are now being accommodated. The questionnaire is going to be pre-tested upon a group of former military personnel to make sure that the questions are understandable and measurable. A contract will be awarded to a nationally recognized health survey organization, and they will administer the final version. Hopefully, that phase will begin in March of 1981. You'll be contacted either by letter or by telephone for that questionnaire. This will be after the letter from the White House and after my letter. And a convenient time will be arranged for you, for the interviewer to come to your home. That interview is going to be lengthy. It will take about 2 to 3 hours. And the ladies can be of significant assistance because you are far better at remembering significant events from the lives of your families, birth dates, illnesses, and whatnot, and we would hope certainly that you would be making a very significant contribution. Within 2 months after that questionnaire has been completed, we'll make an appointment for you to take the physical examination. And it will be performed at a medical facility that will be well recognized in this country as an outstanding facility under Air Force contract. And I know that immediately provokes a question, and I would anticipate it being asked when I finish. Your travel expenses and a per diem will be paid by the Air Force. The first physical examination should take about 4 days. It will be very comprehensive. Our plan is to conduct then another very brief questionnaire at the time of the physical examination, and then repeat that examination at the 1, 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20-year intervals. Your travel expenses and other monetary considerations would apply at each one of those checkpoints. We'll do everything we can to minimize any disruption of your normal activities and to respond to any concerns you may have concerning participation. There will be an informed consent form. As a matter of fact, in flying the some 5.5 hours it took to get here from the West Coast today, I was reviewing that consent form, and believe me, I've red penciled it to ribbons to make certain that it covered everything. And we'll now, after my initial red ribbon or red pencil assault on that form, we'll make sure that it's covered legally. But it details the types of procedures which will be done so that you're going to know exactly what will take place at the time of that physical examination. You're going to get a fact sheet which will provide the general sequence of events of your participation in the study. In addition, you'll receive a Privacy Act statement which will state that you will allow the statistical results of the study to be used by other government officers. Now, please note, I said, and I underlined the word statistical results, not names. Statistical results. We're already screening the records of about 30,000 potential controls. For this to be a meaningful study for each ranch hander, there has to be a series of controls. From these, each of you who participates will be matched against a control of similar age, similar Air Force occupation, time in Vietnam, and race. Both you and your control will go through the identical examination and interview process and follow-up. This protocol has undergone extensive scrutiny by a number of scientific agencies, four to be exact. And we think it's as good as can be devised by the scientific community. I think you would probably have an appreciation that if we sent it to four other scientific groups, it would be chopped on some more. And if we sent it to four more, it would be chopped on even some more. And there comes a time for decision making, and we say we think we probably have it as refined as we can make it at this moment. There's only one thing that's going to make it successful, and that's the ranch hand group. I want, again, to emphasize how important it is for all of you to participate. One of the major criticisms of the whole study has been the size of the sample. We can't improve on the numbers. What will hurt, I think, the science of the undertaking will be the lack of complete participation by ranch hand members. I know that many of you don't feel you have any health problems. And as a doctor, I say that's wonderful. I'm delighted. And I hope you continue in good health. But there are many veterans who have served in Vietnam who believe they do have health difficulties which can be attributed to exposure to herbicide Orange. The only way we can get the answers is for your total cooperation. If there really is a potential for health problems, you and your families will want to know. The Air Force wants to know. And I think the nation also as a whole wants to know. You know and I know that this study isn't going to provide all the answers. But it may well be a key piece of the puzzle. We're going to do everything we can in the Air Force to make it successful. I say to you, will you volunteer for another mission? You've been asked that over and over and over again. It must be old hat by now. But I do indeed ask you to volunteer for one more mission. It certainly isn't dangerous, but it has the potential for a significant impact on a number of Americans. The Air Force has always had a tradition of taking care of its own. And you still are ours in every sense of the word. And I think there's something special about the Blue Suiters looking after the Blue Suiters, whether you're still wearing the uniform as an active duty member or whether you're retired or separated. We do care about you, and I think that's been one of the noble things that our Air Force has always stood for. If you or your friends have any personal concerns which make you reluctant to participate, I invite you to call me, to write to me, to visit me personally, or to talk with George down at the School of Aerospace Medicine at Brooks, and we'll do our very best to answer any questions that you have. I say again to you, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a very rich experience for me tonight to meet you. I have heard so much about you. I want you to know that we're as involved as we can be in the Surgeon General's office, indeed in the Air Force, and in other branches of government, in trying to find answers to an extraordinarily difficult question. I guess the bottom line, and I hate to use trite phrases, but it's quite applicable now, the bottom line really is it's the only study we have, and that in order to make it a success, we need your total cooperation. And now I know with those few brief remarks that already I've generated probably scores of questions, I will be as candid as I know how in keeping with the dictates of, I think, one of the greatest leaders this nation has ever known, General George Brown, former Chief of Staff, and at one time commanded the 7th Air Force. Maybe some of you worked for him. But he said, tell it like it is. I'll try to do that. Any questions?
Just one moment, sir. For the purposes of those recording, because there are some questions or some answers that the General will have to give.
Los países no quieren reducir su producción. Ellos necesitan el dinero. Y entonces producen bastante, han producido tanto que había demasiado durante alguna época. Sí.
¿Por qué no hacen lo que hacen los países que tienen bastante petróleo y produciendo lo mismo?
Sí, sí. Bueno, parece que no puede haber bastante unión entre estos países. Es decir, que los países pobres tienen que vender de todas maneras. Porque si no, ellos baja el precio de su dinero. Si no tienen, porque ellos generalmente tienen que importar mucho. Ese es un problema, es un problema hoy día de los Estados Unidos, que no existía antes, ¿verdad? Pero nosotros importamos más de lo que exportamos. Es decir, que hay más dinero que sale del país de lo que viene al país. Y entonces estos países pobres necesitan moneda extranjera, necesitan dinero de otros países, porque siempre tienen que comprar mucho de otros países, porque no fabrican máquinas, no fabrican automóviles, no fabrican casi nada de lo que usan en las ciudades. Entonces, están en una posición muy difícil. Y si no venden, entonces ellos tienen que pagar más, y entonces el valor del dinero baja. Y como dice aquí la última frase, difícil tarea cuando todos ellos se encuentran en un tren de nuevas inversiones para aumentar el volumen de sus exportaciones. Es decir, que ellos están invirtiendo mucho dinero para poder producir más. Y si no producen más, pierden este dinero. Entonces hay un artículo que, como muchos de los otros, es difícil, porque no le dejan saber a uno lo que pasa, ¿verdad? ¿Qué está pasando? ¿Qué está pasando en este artículo? ¿Señorito Wagner? ¿Va a estar la lista? Antes no está. Just dos, right? Beckley. Broussard. Calhoun. Dobin. Gordon, Greenblum, Henderson, Miller, Presley, Reinhardt. Es que hay Richie Roach Stoddard Deborah Turner Ellen Turner Valentine. Wagner, Nelson. The Williams. Bueno, ¿qué pasa aquí, señorito Wilson? ¿Usted sabe? ¿Qué pasa con...? Dice, el pequeño juez no se dejó atemorizar. Que es una cita, ¿verdad? En ese caso, por lo menos, han puesto la puntuación para la cita. Pero, ¿qué están...? ¿A qué se refieren aquí? Sí, a una película, sí. ¿Se acuerdan del final de la película Z? Es decir, que había una película Z, y el final, al final de la película, dijeron, el pequeño juez no se dejó atemorizar. Well, que estaban tratando de asustar al juez, pero él no se dejó asustar, ¿verdad? No se asustó. Y entonces, bueno, no se sabe lo que pasó después, ¿verdad? Bueno, se sabe en la realidad, en la película no se sabe, pero en la realidad es lo que ellos están hablando, ¿verdad? ¿Se acuerdan el final de la película, etcétera? Claro que sí. Millones de espectadores vieron el film. De 30 a 40 millones de personas en el mundo. Bueno, bastante, sí.
¿Cuántos dicen en la película que lo que uno ve en la película pasó en realidad?
Sí, pasó en realidad, sí. Es decir, que la película estaba basada en algo que pasó en la realidad. Y entonces todavía están hablando de la película, ¿verdad? Dicen, Denner corrió hacia la mujer del hombre asesinado, diputado de izquierda y profesor de medicina en Salónica, y le comunicó la buena noticia de que el joven juez no había tenido miedo. Acababa de inculpar a los protagonistas del atentado de complicidad en homicidio voluntario con premeditación. Esta es la película. Es la película. Y entonces, él ahora se cambia. Y aquí está la continuación del caso Lambrakis que relataba Zeta. Okay, so he's saying here, he's talking first, just in his first couple of paragraphs about the film and what happened in the film. And then when he says, y aquí está la continuación, he means not above, but below. Now we'll talk about the continuation of the case, because we don't know what happened in the film, you know. After that, that was the last thing that happened. The judge didn't let himself be, what would you say, loved, intimidated, yeah. Y entonces, Lambrakis es una persona ficticia que relataba, he was the narrator of the film, so he was telling what happened. And so at the end, he said, the little judge did not let himself be intimidated. Sí. Hoy día, no en una película, sino en la vida real, los coroneles se apresuraron a reintegrar en el ejercicio de sus funciones a los jefes culpables. Ellos son el general Mitsu, el coronel Kamutsis, el comandante Diamandopoulos y el teniente Capelonis. Y entonces, ¿quiénes son estas personas?
Los que estaban en posesión.
Sí, exactamente. Que el juez había dio testimonio para mandar a estos coroneles a la prisión. Pero ellos habían salido ya de la prisión. Y entonces estaban bueno, para vengarse con el juez, ¿verdad?
Y ahora tienen puestos de poder.
Sí, ahora están en el ejército, tienen puestos en que tienen poder, sí. Otra vez. So, los coroneles, ¿quiénes son los coroneles en este caso? Bueno, son... Bueno, es decir, es el gobierno militar de Grecia. Cuando él dice los coroneles, está hablando del gobierno militar de Grecia, ¿verdad? Y ellos reintegraron en el ejército a los, al general Mitsu, el coronel, el comandante, el teniente, ¿verdad? A cuatro personas que culpables que habían mandado a la prisión. In other words, it's like, well, we have here, ¿cómo se llama? John, Mitchell, and the four of them, say, had been, they got out of jail now, you know, and they put them back into the government. It's the same sort of thing. Except that in this case, it was a little bit worse, in one sense anyway, because they had plotted to kill members of the opposition. So, el acusado principal, Spiros Kotsamanis, condenado a 11 años de prisión, fue liberado el año pasado. Y yo no sé en qué año pasó esto en principio. Bueno, yo creo en los años 50 habrá sido.
Were those people really sent to prison?
Yeah, no, they were really sent to prison. Yeah. There were some some members of the army, which was the governing organ in Greece, who plotted to kill members of the opposition. And a judge found out about it, and he testified against them, and they put pressure on him not to testify. But he testified anyway. Now, in the film, you don't know if he's going to testify, or all you know is that he's going to testify against them. Yet. The film ends when the narrator says, he wasn't intimidated. In other words, he was going to go ahead and testify.
I thought this guy was the judge of the trial. I didn't realize he was a witness.
No, he's a witness.
He was in the trial.
Right. Okay, you're right.
Okay, I'm getting lost.
I mean,
enough trouble with this.
He was the judge that incriminated the people in prison that got out later on. Now he's on trial.
But now he didn't know, did he? I don't think he sentenced them.
Yeah. Because he accuses them, they end up dismissing him and sending him.
Well, I know, but the thing is, you see, he was not accused until after these army officials got out of jail, and then they trumped up charges against him. But no,
I know, where did I ever see that it said they were actually in jail?
Yeah, no, this is not in the movie. This says, y aquí está la continuación del caso Lambrakis que relatábase hoy día, no en una película, sino en la vida real. Okay, so then from here on, where it says, sino en la vida real, right, they're telling you about what actually happened. Los coroneles se apresuraron a reintegrar, although it doesn't really explain it very well.
Yeah, they hurried to pay back. It doesn't say they hurried prison.
No, I know, but they put them back into their former jobs. And then, el acusado principal, Spiros Kotsamanis, condenado a 11 años de prisión, fue liberado el año pasado. So this was the main person who was liberated, who was freed from jail last year. In other words, the one in charge of the plot, I presume.
Estos últimos días, el Consejo Judicial del Distrito de Salónica decidió poner en libertad al último prisionero del ruidoso caso, o sea, Emmanuel Manulidis. Así es que había varios en la prisión. Y entonces este fue el último que pusieron en libertad. El tribunal no había tenido en cuenta la acusación según la cual este había golpeado al diputado en la película Yves Montand con una barra de hierro. In other words, they had ignored that testimony in the trial. Había sido condenado a 8 años y medio de prisión por complicidad. Como desquite, los coroneles acaban de arrestar al pequeño juez valiente. So, now that these are out of jail, they arrest the judge, que se llama Christos Sarsetakis. Tenía 34 años en el momento del caso, hoy tiene 42. Okay, so I assume that this must be in 1971. And that was 6, 7, 8 years before, so that must have been 1963 that it happened. So he was 34 years old when he gave the testimony. And now, at this time, where they don't know when this article is written, what's going to happen to him.
I think that's what confused me, because that last sentence there, in revenge, they had just arrested the judge. I didn't know whether it was in revenge for the colonels being arrested, or in revenge for this guy getting released.
No, it was in revenge for having testified against the army officers 8 years before. So the thing is that they didn't take any action against him so long as the other guys were in jail. I guess because they might have extended their term, I don't know why. But as soon as everybody was out of jail, they arrested the judge that had testified against them.
Was he a judge at the time he testified against him, or he later?
Yeah. No, I think he was a judge at the time he testified, yeah.
He wasn't acting as a judge in the case, though, right? He was just a...
No, he was just, I believe, he just gave testimony. Now, somebody was saying that I don't recall anything in the article that says that he was a judge.
Yeah, it says there because the guy thought that he would only take a month to investigate it, and instead he took 20 months to try the case.
He was the judge in the case, right. Yeah.
They thought that since he was a new guy, he just
took
the easy way out.
Right.
So that's why they were so angry.
Right. Yeah.
Says his investigators lasted 20 months, and finally, or he, at the end, he found them or blamed them all of implication.
Yeah. Okay. Entonces, bueno, cuenten algo sobre él. Bueno, primero en la página 90, es decir, ellos no tenían derecho de llevarlo al juez, ¿verdad? Porque el artículo 10 de la Constitución de los Coroneles que garantiza el habeas corpus no funcionó. In other words, you can't do anything to anybody after the thing. El hombre que lo arrestó es el capitán Mitsu, hijo del mismo general que había sido inculpado en el caso Lambrakis. Lo enviaron inmediatamente a Atenas, a la sección especial de la Policía Militar, etc. Y entonces cuenta de él, que es un conservador, ¿verdad? Que no es ningún hombre de izquierda que podría haber sido políticamente opuesto al gobierno. Y entonces en No Se Pliega, it's got translated here, does not bend down. I think the literal translation here is better, which is what? He doesn't fold. Plegado doesn't fold. Y entonces,
En 1967, mientras se encontraba en París, donde trabajaba en una tesis de doctorado en la universidad, el Ministerio de Justicia griega lo llamó un mes después del golpe de los coroneles. Ah, sí. So when he testified, actually, the military was not in power. And the military took power
in 67. The uprising in Greece, and the military took over the government. Mm-hmm.
So in 63, the case was in 63 then. So in 67, the military took over. And then 4 years later, in 70, they arrested him. Y lo obligó a regresar a Salónica. Se fue entonces pensando que era su deber. Este razonamiento le costará caro. Un año más tarde, en 1968, un acto constitucional del gobierno suspende durante 3 días la inamovilidad de los magistrados, y cerca de 30 magistrados, incluyendo a Sarsetakis, son destituidos. In other words, they had a position something like the judges of the Supreme Court in the United States. They had a lifetime right to their position, but they suspended this right for 3 days and arrested 30 judges during those 3 days. And he was one of them. Un numeral de este acto constitucional prohíbe una eventual anulación. That is, they couldn't do away with the act itself, so they just suspended it for 3 days till they could arrest all the judges who were against it. Pero como Sarsetakis no es un hombre que se pliegue, y para él la ley no es un instrumento que se manipula según las oportunidades, el 25 de julio de 1968 redacta un memorándum para el Consejo de Estado en el que ataca la decisión tomada contra él. Así es que se defiende él legalmente, ¿verdad? Por procesos legales se está defendiendo. Y entonces él protesta. Les escribe también un memorándum diciendo que ellos están en contra de él políticamente y por eso van a hacer todo lo posible en contra. Entonces, el 24 de enero de 1969, los altos funcionarios del Consejo de Estado, ¿cómo sería esto en los Estados Unidos? Como, I guess like the cabinet of the Congress, right? It'd be a smaller group, more like cabinet members, yeah. I think. Proclamaban que la destitución de los magistrados era ilegal. Este hecho fue una bofetada al gobierno. In other words, they declared that the act of the military in suspending the tenure for these judges was illegal. El presidente del Consejo de Estado sufrió las consecuencias. Se le obligó a renunciar. So, the president of this group had resigned. Ante lo cual varios consejeros renunciaron voluntariamente. Sin embargo, los magistrados destituidos permanecieron en la misma situación, ya que los coroneles elaboraron una nueva ley de efecto retroactivo. Y entonces esta es la razón por la cual durante 20 meses Cristo Sarsetakis se quedó sin trabajo, viviendo muy mal de algunos préstamos. Él no tenía derecho de trabajar de juez, ¿verdad?, durante este tiempo. Y nadie atrevió a aceptarlo como abogado, ¿verdad?, para trabajar de abogado. I still don't see where you get this thing that he presided over the case, though.
And on the conservador, to investigation, that whole paragraph.
Okay, se le puede confiar sin problemas esa investigación, piensa el fiscal.
The district attorney, the district attorney or whatever his level is,
yeah.
Is appointing him.
I guess that's right.
He won't commit the folly of lasting the process
yeah.
within a month, and then.
Yeah. So he won't. Yeah, he wouldn't commit the folly of making the case last more than a month. Sin embargo, este pequeño juez conservador no es ciego. Se trata de un complot en el cual están implicados personajes importantes del gobierno, pero no se dejará intimidar. Su investigación dura 20 meses y al final inculpa a todos los implicados.
That's what I don't really know what the process is here, but it doesn't seem to me like this is actually a trial. Apparently they have a process where the judge is actually in charge of the investigation, not rather than being a trial, something like that, it seems to me, su investigación dura 20 meses y al final inculpa a todos los implicados. His investigation, you know, that's really an investigation in the sense that we use the term as a legal term, a legal investigation. So apparently a judge
says
there...
Since he blamed or he accused, I mean, he has to have some authority there, because when he ends his investigation...
Inculpa a todos los implicados. He puts the finger on all of the accused, on all of the ones that were implicated in the case. A pesar de las amenazas de muerte que le hacen por teléfono y de las presiones del procurador general Collins, ni en la derecha ni en la izquierda se le atribuía tanto coraje. And coraje is used a lot in the sense of anger as well as courage.
One of the questions I ask over this is what political position did he hold? And the only thing I can figure out that
what it means here, I'm sure.
His political feelings, he says, he's kind of neutral.
I think what it just means there that he's a conservative.
Oh, okay.
He's not a
rather as a job
I don't really know how this. Somehow I had the impression that he wasn't like a presiding judge, you know, to take testimony, and that he made the decision. But, I think this is the way it happens. I don't know who I can ask to find out. Yeah, I saw it, but it's been a long time ago, and I can't. And I may be getting things from the movie mixed up.
The magistrate,
right?
And it says he, along with 30 other magistrates, so he's again that.
Yeah.
Well, probably jump around. It's confusing, both in the time sense.
Whether
he's free or arrested, who's being arrested?
Yeah. Yeah, the thing is that the article is really very difficult to follow. It's
the very last sentence on page 91. Who is arrested 2 months? The colonel dismissed him in 1968.
That's the judge who is arrested. Los coroneles lo destituyeron en 1968. In other words, then was when they took his job away from him. Y hace 2 meses lo colocaron detrás de las rejas.
Does that say 2 months later? 2 months ago?
No, and then, 2 months ago.
Okay.
So now this is,
this
is 1971, I presume. So.
Okay.
So probably it must have been in 71 that they put
it. Was up in 70. He was writing an article.
I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to look up a news magazine for that period of time and see if it explains anything about what actually happened. Because
I
read something about it then and saw the movie and I'm confused now.
The article seemed to assume you'd seen the movie.
Yeah, I know. Well,
that didn't make much sense.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
our thing is that this sort of thing is seen by practically everybody in Latin America who reads. Movies there, well, I can't really say this about Peru anymore, but Lima, they used to have foreign films, you know, from countries, from all foreign countries, any major film would be featured for months in the capitals in Latin America. And so it's something, you know, as you say, they just assume that you've seen the movie, and they also assume that you know the story. One of the differences between education in Latin America and in the United States is that there it's much broader, and people who are well educated are expected to be up to all kinds of information, all historical, cultural, artistic news and everything else. You know, I became aware of that the first time when I started trying to do these test your IQ or something like that, you know, in the Mexican magazines. And when I came out an idiot on some of them, I didn't say, well, they must learn something else. And the thing is that, you know, they weren't things from Mexico. I mean, they were stuff from Europe or stuff from the classical world, you know, things like that. But it's just that I did a little experiment last semester with my advanced class because we were reading Ernesto Sábato, an Argentine writer. He was just writing a general essay, but he mentioned 200 people in the course of the essay as people that he just expected everybody to know who they were. And so I went through them with the class, and I think there were 8 of them that everybody in the class knew. They were Michelangelo, Leonardo da Vinci, and then some Americans. No, Bolivar, they didn't know. But it was kind of an intellectual history, you know. It wasn't really much on Latin America, but it's just the people. I went over time last time because my watch was slow, so I put my little alarm. Y'all can hear this, huh? I have a hard time hearing it sometimes. Maybe I better have my hearing. But this is, and the reason is, you know, not only that he expects you to have seen the movie and to know about the case, but that the article is poorly written. You know, as writing, it's just that he doesn't pay enough attention to the problems of the reader.
Of course, if you think about the United States, if somebody's written something related to the movie Jaws, they would expect almost every reader to have seen it based on a magazine.
Yeah.
Is this a great
genocidio mental, según Muñoz? Y entonces, sobre este artículo de hoy, ¿cuáles fueron dos de los problemas más serios del ejército norteamericano en Vietnam? ¿En qué consistía la fragmentación en Vietnam? ¿Y qué relación tenía con la zanja de generaciones? Esto contestaron mal en general. ¿En qué consistía la fragmentación y qué relación tenía con la zanja de generaciones? ¿Por qué corrían peligro los blancos que entraban a un barrio marginal que se llamaba Soul Alley en Vietnam? ¿Y qué era el DAP que practicaban los negros en Vietnam? ¿En qué sentido podría el ejército de los Estados Unidos en Vietnam constituir una amenaza para la nación que había jurado defender? Y entonces pregunté cuál fue el artículo que usted encontró más interesante entre los que leyó en la prensa hasta ahora. ¿Y por qué?
Question 11 on page 70.
he's 27 now, but my father said he was only going to speak Spanish to him. And my mother gradually learned it, of course. But when he started school, he was made so much fun of. Everyone teased him so much that he wouldn't, you know, he was, but today he can't speak
English.
He's very, very poor.
In English?
No, in Spanish.
Oh, no.
My father doesn't even know that.
That happens a lot of times, and our children actually have tried to speak English to us, particularly, the fall of 1976 and 77. Both times, they would come home, and my daughter said, why do I have to switch to Spanish? Because I'm thinking in English and I'm talking English all day. And we don't forget Spanish otherwise. And so we just, and not only that, we insisted that they read in Spanish. And still insisted that they read in Spanish every day. They can.
But they read in English every day too.
Oh yeah. But the thing is that they're above the 90th percentile in comparison, in reading in comparison with Puerto Rican children. And above the 90th in English, and reading English compared to American children. And in a lot of scores, they're 99th percentile, 98th percentile.
There's this family close to ours at home, and they're Chinese. And they wouldn't let their kids speak English in the house, they had to speak Chinese. And they'd go to school, and they wouldn't understand a word, and they'd come home, and they'd sit around the house all afternoon because they didn't have any friends that spoke Chinese.
Yeah.
It was a relatively rare language around here. I mean,
yeah.
You can usually find some little kids somewhere who speak Spanish. But those kids sat around the house and watched TV all afternoon because they didn't have any friends.
Yeah.
Because their parents wouldn't even hardly let them associate with any English American people.
Yeah.
They just, they said, you are Chinese and you'll be Chinese if you are living in America.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we've never had that kind of attitude about them associating with other children. In fact, they've almost associated almost entirely with English speaking children. But they forced the English speaking children to learn enough Spanish to talk with them. They're very strong-minded.
What do you think about families that teach your children both English and Spanish at the same time?
I've seen families do that very successfully, where one parent will speak to the child in English and another parent in Spanish. And my objection to that is that it's usually the mother who speaks Spanish. And the mother has less prestige in the family than the father. And so when the children, and prestige is a major element in whether the children accept or don't accept the language. And I don't know how this
works. It was the other way around in our family.
Yeah.
But I
decided they were going to get an education in Spanish, no matter whether they got one in English or not. I don't approve of the type of education people get in English in the United States anyway. I think it's, you know, for dead ends generally. And so I wanted to give them a good education in Spanish, and I know they're getting it. Now, if they get a good education in English, that's obviously good. But if they don't, at least they've got one in Spanish.
Someone said that you can teach a child as many three or four languages at once because they really don't.
Oh, yeah. No, they don't.
One language and another. I remember when I was first taught to speak Spanish, and I went to school, and I had learned a little bit of English, and I would talk to the teacher, and she thought I was a retard because I would speak to her and mix both languages because I didn't know that I was speaking two languages.
Yeah.
And everybody else understood me except the teacher. She thought I was stupid.
Yeah. Yeah. In fact, they sent my daughter to the speech therapist, and the speech therapist, the principal, the teacher, and the counselor all called me and my wife in for a conference, and they said that when she was in kindergarten, and she was already reading in English when she was 5 months in kindergarten, and none of the other children were. So they told us that they suggested strongly that we stop speaking Spanish at home. And I said,
said, well, I said, I thought my daughter was doing fine in English, that she still didn't pronounce it well, but she was reading in English and the other children weren't. And they said, well, it's not exactly that. The thing is that she thinks that Spanish is a better language than English, and she'll keep thinking so as long as her parents use it. I thought, well, it is a better language than English. But like in English, you've got the A, say. How many ways can you pronounce the A?
Oh, yeah.
You've got 13 ways. Well, you've got 5 ways to pronounce the A, basically. And you've got 13 ways to represent those 5 pronunciations. And in Spanish, you've got 1 way to pronounce the A, and you've got 1 way to represent it. And so the child has practically nothing to learn reading. And so they're in reading, and I'm making fun of this in the paper that I'm writing with the Houston group. They have, they start out with stupid little poems and things like that. And the things that you read are really like they're written for idiots. And in the first grade reader in Mexico, you start out with the great poetry of the great poets of the Hispanic tradition from Spain, Uruguay, from Nicaragua, Peru, from everywhere. You know. You have, in the first grade reader, you have 14 of the best poets and the Spanish language represented. And in English, you've got things like my money back, my money monkey, you know, I put a nickel in his mouth. And, I'm like climbing the tree with my friend. I'm going to have a hamburger on the bun or something like that. So as far as I'm concerned, they're just not. And as a matter of fact, the children were learning all the capitals. They've learned all the capitals of the American continent in the last couple of days. And my wife was visiting the school, and she said something to one of the teachers, and she said, well, I've been teaching the American capitals. And he said, oh, yes, it's good to know the capitals of the states. But what is she was teaching the capitals? The American capitals are the capitals of Peru, of Argentina, it's not the capital of Texas. That's not the American capitals. I mean, that's it's the very narrow thinking that's done in the schools. It's typical. It's the way people think here. The rest of the world doesn't exist. It's just, incidental. Así es que yo creo que tiene razón, ¿verdad?, en cierto sentido aquí, aunque no es como él dice, con todo propósito, o a propósito. It's not intentional in that sense. As a matter of fact, there's one American who works a lot, a businessman, actually, worked a lot in Latin America. I wrote a book about it. I can't remember his name right now. But he said that in the book that people had the wrong idea that we Americans do things out of ill will, And he said that we wouldn't be nearly so dangerous if we did things out of ill will. He said that it's because we mean so well that we're so dangerous in the rest of the world. Because we really think, that what we have is better for them. And we really think, we're really convinced of all these things. And I think this is true of education here. The criticism is unjustified because all the teachers and all of the people in education, they believe they're really doing the best that can be done. In fact, when I was teaching high school, we were meeting about the education of Spanish speaking students there, who comprise more than half the high school, Southern High School in Texas, and the principal had gone along with a lot of my ideas, but his sister was on the school board, and when I started telling her what I thought was wrong and what should be done, she started crying, and I didn't know what to say, what to do. She said, "But how could anyone think that we're not doing our best for these people?" But this is it's the saddest thing about it, as far as I'm concerned. The excuse for ignorance.
Bueno, de todas maneras, hay alguna pregunta sobre esto. Es un artículo no muy bueno,
No muy bien escrito. Hay algunas cosas muy exageradas, como dijo el señor Ciso, que en la primera página 51, por ejemplo, dice la gente llamada Square los marcó y los condenó a muerte. Newspaper writers particularly do this a lot. That is, they use words which sound a lot stronger than what they may mean. Because you could translate that literally as that they put their finger on them and marked them for death. Or it could mean that they noticed they were different and decided that they should disband. In other words, that the group should be destroyed. So you don't know what he means, really.
Too young.
And real wide, blue shoulders.
Broad, sharp shoulders, narrow waist, big long chain.
He had a big old hat and a big old wide tie. Baggiest pants you ever did see.
Peg, though. They were peg. Baggy at the knees, but peg out there.
And these were, originally, these were Mexican Americans from El Paso, Texas. They go